Hello, interwebs, and welcome to another episode of Paul Owen and Dr. Witt's Colloquium on Games of Strategy by Dixit, Skeith, and Riley. Today is episode 5, and we have a special guest with us.
We have Douglas Schultz from Lucid Phoenix Games to talk about his lovely discussion point on actually our very first episode.
Hello, thanks for having me. And thanks for getting me into the book. It's been a good read so far, even though I'm well behind you guys.
Well, you know, we have to stay ahead of you so you can bin read and bin watch. I mean, isn't that modern consumption? Is you want the whole series done first so you don't have to wait for the next episode?
Absolutely.
And now we have participatory discussions. Paul, why don't you take a moment to introduce yourself?
Sure. This is Paul Owen. I've been part of this colloquium, of course, with Aaron and Austin of Dr. Witz. People might know me from Dice Tower News or my blog, the Man Overboard blog, paulowengames.blogspot.com, or more likely on Twitter at Paul Owen Games.
And I'm Aaron Hanswitz, the other half of Dr. Witz. People might better know me as the person who just gave them their final exam for the semester in at Bethany College.
And I am Austin Smokowitz, the other half of Dr. Witz. So, Doug, why don't you tell us what inspired you to write your blog post and bring us all here today?
Yeah, no, thank you. The conversation you guys are having in the podcast about this first, I guess, chapter or two, where you were talking about the definition of a game that the authors came up with. And one of the key points of it that you talked about a lot was the idea that it's not a game of strategy unless that there are multiple people who are, you know, aware of all of the strategic choices and are making these choices, knowing that the other person's aware that, you know, they're all making choices as part of this game. So as a little bit of backstory, a game I've been working on for several years, I spent a lot of time working on a solo game implementation for it and put a lot of work into building that out. And so, you know, the idea of solo games was kind of on my mind. And it occurred to me that by that definition, no solo game could be a game because there's no other person. It's just you. And as I was thinking about that and writing some comments on these first chapters, you know, I think you come with this line of, well, okay, so I could guess I could make an argument that a solo game isn't a game, even if there's an AI. How complicated can the AI be before it becomes a game? And in board games, you know, that's one level, but then you get into computer games and a lot of them have really involved in-depth AIs. And even if they aren't as involved in in-depth, you don't really have a good sense because it's hidden. The mechanics are hidden for the AI. So you don't really know, is the AI taking into account what you're doing and the choices you're making? Is it making choices knowing that you might make a certain choice in response? And does that get to the point where it's kind of a game anyways? And then Paul had the great response, I thought, about how that meant we clearly needed a Turing test for solo game AIs, which I thought was a good way to kind of summing up that idea of at what point does the solo game become a game?
Okay. Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I think of it sometimes when a designer sets up an AI for a solo game, it's almost like he's playing the whole game ahead of time. He's creating a strategy for the AI. And in a sense, he's made his interactive decisions, if you like. He's made his decisions against a future opponent who's going to play the game solo and laid it out in a strategy and constructed that strategy in the form of the AI. And so you are, in a sense, retroactively interacting with the decisions that he's made. And in that sense, you might call it a game rather than a constructed puzzle. But yeah, you're right. I like your point about the fact that if you don't have insight into the algorithms on which the AI is based, then it's not merely a puzzle to be solved. If you're playing Pandemic, you know exactly how the game works. Theoretically, you could map out all the possible arrangements of the deck of cards, and it would be strictly a puzzle. But when you're playing, say, a video game, right, or a solo game where you don't have complete insight into the algorithm, then you almost have to treat it like a game where an opponent is making decisions and account for that, and then game theory starts to apply.
Well, I find that to be an interesting point because the way I was thinking about it is that it's almost a question of if the computer or the opponent is actually taking into account what you are doing and thus reacting to you. It's an interesting point, Paul, where you're talking about how this idea that the AI, the solo game, is not interacting to your responses, but has already pre-programmed itself out, mm-hmm. thus already trying to anticipate your moves. But the way I think about it is that even in a game like Pandemic, I'm reacting to what the AI is throwing at me. I'm acting, mm-hmm. I'm reacting to what the diseases are doing. The diseases are not then reacting to what I am doing back to it. It's not saying, right. oh, you think you're going to clear out all the blacks, all the black diseases. Mm-hmm. No. Right. We're going to push back against that and sneak in a little bit of yellow while we're at it.
To me, one of the things I thought about, I think you're right, but especially that idea of the fact that the AI, I mean, at best, maybe to Paul's point, it's trying to proactively anticipate what the real player's choices are going to be and kind of react ahead of time. But probably most likely it's just not reacting to the actual people's plays. So one of the things that got me to thinking about is there a way to, when you have an AI, either in a solo game or a cooperative game, is there a way to try to insert some reaction into your AI so that it is actually taking into account what other people do? You know, maybe there's some basic tree branching that can occur within your AI that is dependent on what the last action that the players took or some threshold that the players may have achieved.
Mm-hmm.
But because that is the other thing that I start really, as you really start thinking about whether or not AIs, playing against AIs, makes it a game or not, the next thing I was thinking about was, you know, if you're designing another game with an AI in it, how can you make that AI behave as much like a real person, a real player, as possible to make it that much more interesting?
Right. That's the tricky part, I guess.
Particularly in a board game.
Right.
Don't come with a nice little computer algorithm just to do it for you. You have to create some preset rules that this AI is going to follow, which
right.
adds the added complication. The players are going to see the preset rules, unless it's something completely random.
Well, there's one good example I like to point to is the COIN series, the Counterinsurgency series. And the way that they handle that is that they are always four-player games. Even if you don't have four people at the table, they must, by the very nature of their systems, they must be four players. So what they've come up with is if you have somebody who's absent or somebody not playing a faction, there is a flowchart that you look down to decide what that faction does on their turn. And right. it's one of those things where the flowchart essentially does a bunch of checks on the game state. And depending on if it meets certain conditions or not, the AI will come to a result as to what it should do on its turn. I think that gets you that one step closer to having an AI player in a board game, because it is a thing that is actively checking the conditions of the game and responding to what those conditions are.
You know, and that's interesting too. Because theoretically, you could study the entire flowchart ahead of time, right?
Right.
But then, so a counterexample, or I guess a case of a game you could play solo where you can't study it ahead of time, would be a choose your own adventure, where the game is still reacting to players' decisions, but you don't necessarily know how the game is going to react. It depends on how the author wrote the story, so to speak.
You didn't read ahead in the book.
So in that case, you could have.
Turn back the page with a bad
So here's another example. What about, I haven't never played Pandemic Legacy, but there's certainly a case where the game reacts to players' actions in a way that players can't anticipate.
The other thing I was thinking is that if you have that branching tree that from the COIN series, but you weren't 100% certain when those tipping points were, so maybe the tipping points were slightly different from game to game, or there was some way of not completely randomizing the tree, because if you randomize it too much, then you're probably reducing the effectiveness of these AI players. But creating enough of an uncertainty there, because I could definitely see in something like that where you know that if a certain threshold gets to X, you're in trouble, because you don't want the AI to shift their strategy or do the thing that's going to trigger. And so I could say, especially if you've played the game a couple of times, learning, I don't want them to get to that, and really trying to keep that check just below that threshold. But if you, you know, I don't know, had a deck of cards or something, or some, you know, randomizer where that threshold could raise or lower a little bit, that might be an interesting way to try and get there.
Then it becomes like a push or luck kind of a game.
The element to it, yeah, I guess, yeah. But one of the things I just remember that I thought about too when I was thinking about AI is that I think plays into this is the whole idea, and we touched on it a little bit earlier, Paul did, that if you don't realize, know whether or not the game's taking into these things into account, or you kind of, and with board games, that's a little hard because there's much more obvious systems. But if you get to the point where everything's obscured enough that you don't really know what's going on and how the decisions are being made, then, you know, if it feels like the game's taking what you did into account, does it matter if it really does?
Yeah.
As long as it's still trying to win, right?
Right.
Yeah, 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 true.
But that's just a puzzle in the end. I mean, first time you play it, yeah, neat. I don't know what's going on. But that second, that third, that fourth time, you start figuring out the puzzle. And so you have that challenge of, do I want to repeatedly play the puzzle, or do I want to deal with something different? And doing something different means I have to, in essence, create a new algorithm for me to figure out.
And I think what's also interesting about this conversation is that we're almost talking about two different things at the same time. So there's the challenge of creating an AI player who will play against you at the table as another player in the game that can essentially take over for one of the seats at the game. But then there's the other, a more interesting, I feel, design challenge of creating a solo game where the game itself is reacting to what you're doing as it goes on. I mean, and I feel that that's a more interesting challenge because that means that you have to build those reactive systems into the game itself, as opposed to an AI player that is looking at the game state and your decisions and making its decisions based off of that. Is that making sense?
I think they're definitely different. You know, the difference between, I think maybe another way of saying it is the difference between designing a co-op AI where the AI does things that are completely different. It's almost asymmetric from what the players do, as opposed to AIs that effectively have the same game choices as the players.
Right. And so the difference between the coin series sort of robot player as opposed to Pandemic, where it's in a game system.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
And I agree that they're I agree that they're different challenges. I'm not sure it's a harder challenge to build the co-op AI. I think one of the challenges of building an AI that is like the coin system is that when you're building a co-op AI, you can, because that system has completely different choices and completely different mechanics than the players do, you can mold them around making the AI effective. But usually you're probably bolting this player AI on top of a game that's already been developed and designed. And now you've got to think about, well, how do I mimic a player? And you're probably trying to do it in a way that the AI player is effective or could be effective and not just kind of get in the way. And I think it's just a different kind of challenge, but I'm not sure it's necessarily difficult or easier. Of course, I could be just saying that because I just did that. So I'm.
I was waiting for you to mention Championship Formula Racing because all that time creating those different drivers.
Yeah, so that was an interesting effort, and it took a couple years of on and off development work to do it. But I mean, I think for me, one of the eases was I just knew the game so well, and obviously designers are going to have that tendency. And the more you've had a game, that game's been sitting around for so long because it was a re-implementation of an older game that I'd played for years. So, you know, I had advantages of being able to think about the game a lot and as a player and trying to break the game down into decision points that made sense and seeing all the different kind of strategies different people can take within the game and trying to model that. But the kind of the takeaways I got from that was some of the things we've touched on, the idea of having some randomness, having different parts to a strategy, which it sounds like Coin was doing as well, where, you know, you've got some branching trees based on different game states. The one thing I never really got into, which I think would have been interesting to explore, and I may try and explore in future tinkering, is the idea of really trying to react to what other players are doing. There's not a ton of that in the system. And I think there might be some potential for that. I just have to think about how to do something like that. But I mean, it's a racing game. So the idea of like what position you're in or where you are in the pack is a thing that, you know, you could use, or how short on resources are the opponents as opposed to you. And really, but the flip side of that is I don't think you want to make those trees too complicated. You know, if there was a computer program running behind this or an app, which I actually thought would have been an interesting way to do that, you can add a little bit more complexity to that, taking in more things into account. And I think the system I ended up making is pretty complicated, but I hesitate to add more complexity onto that, add more weight onto the people who are trying to implement it.
Right. That's the other challenge in board game design in particular.
Yeah.
Well, it still faces a tough question. When you put this piece together, even at your best effort, is this really a game from the perspective of game theory? I mean, the big thing that game theory is going to push here is that you're trying to read someone who not just has asymmetric information, but the ability to change and read you in a way it's endogenous. And the challenge of that complexity makes it really hard, as Paul was saying, to do in a board game.
Yeah.
How can you read something and not just read it, but be able to let it be creative in such a way where it has the ability to bluff, where it has the ability to be forced to make a credible signal or not make a credible signal?
Yeah, and I don't think I achieved any of that, to be fair. And I've played games where it's just me against a bunch of AIs, and it's fun and it's really interesting. But you're right, I'm not. It's different than playing against people, where you're trying to read tendencies or you're trying to outguess them in certain situations. You do a little bit less of that, or sometimes it's just puzzle solving. I have a really strong suspicion they're going to do this because I kind of know how the AI is going to want to behave here. So, which is, you're right, it's different. It's not the same. And you're right, they're signaling and bluffing is not really there. The randomizing can sometimes be like bluffing, maybe, but
maybe
it's different. And there's certainly no signaling.
You know, I ran across, it was an online implementation of Resistance, and it allowed you to play Resistance against all AIs. And I tried it once, and I realized that makes no sense at all, because the essence of the game is negotiation and bluffing and salesmanship in a way, but it's not a logic puzzle in its own right. You know, I mean, it doesn't give you sufficient information to be a real logic puzzle. It's almost entirely random otherwise. So yeah, I'm curious about championship formula racing. Is that the kind of game where you are trying to anticipate whether a certain driver is going to be aggressive or hang back or whatever, or do you bluff each other in a game like that?
You definitely see some anticipation of what other people are going to do. There's a lot of situations, especially when you're going like into a corner and you're right next to somebody and there's one way you want to go. And so now you have to try and figure out, well, is that guy going to try and go the same way I'm going? And if so, is he going to be in my way? And if so, then do I try to do something to make sure I go first? There's some riskier behavior you can engage in to try and make sure you get there before he does. So yeah, you do see that when you're playing the game in person with a bunch of people that, you know, are experienced players, you will sometimes see bluffing. It's usually in the form, because there, you will simultaneously secretly place on the table what speed you're going to go next turn, which is kind of your key decision point there, where you're trying to outguess your opponent. You know, you don't have to tell people where you're going, but you can make stuff up. People can ask you what you're going to do. You can lie to them. So, you know, it can happen. And I've seen situations where people have kind of faked out other people in certain situations where they were convinced the person was going to go one way and they didn't. And because they didn't go the way they anticipated, something happened. It was good or bad for one of them. Right. And I struggle with whether you really get that with the AIs, because, you know, sometimes there's the AIs will do things and, you know, I'll be like, okay, I wasn't sure that we're going to do that. But there's definitely situations where I know the AI is not going to do a thing.
Right.
And I can do that thing.
You can take advantage of that now.
Yes, there are definitely some blind spots in the AIs that I have noticed and seen as I've played with them more, that maybe I'll try and correct at some point. But
which makes them a great learning tool. The thing I do like about the AIs is that we've talked about how in games you are trying to game out all possibilities And if your game's complex enough, then having these AIs can be a good way of saying, oh, that's a bad strategy. Why did I do that? Or if someone does that, I can take advantage of them for doing it.
Yeah.
And I will say that for the coin games, even though there is that nice flow chart, I have read that people have said that, well, it's still not the same as a human player because it doesn't take into effect things that have happened in the past and predicting things that may happen in the future. It's always kind of looking at the state turn by turn. So it will get the job done. It will try to push its own agendas. But in the grander scheme of things, it is still not the same as playing against a human. And it is a better like teaching tool of, oh, this is how this player should play, because that flowchart was created by the designers trying to say, this is how this player should play this faction.
I find that an interesting assertion because I'm not entirely sure I would ever play Championship Formula Racing the way any of the AIs are built. I mean, there's definitely ones that are kind of inspired by maybe strategies I might take or strategies I've seen other people take, you know, because it's a game that you can sit up to 12 on. And I felt like you needed a lot of diversity in strategies. You can't have like three strategies. And then if you've got like nine AIs, everyone's doing three of them are all the same. It's just,
right.
So some of the strategies are terrible. Mostly, usually terrible. Every once in a while, they luck out or some situation works with them. But
see that car in last place? Don't be like that car.
Yeah, don't ever do that. The U strategy is terrible. Don't ever do that in real life. And the random strategy is not very good either. But
funny, always good for a laugh.
They are.
So in a sense, I guess thinking about that Turing test thing, the AIs of the card game, clearly, I mean, even if you could mask the physical mechanics of it so that you didn't know that you were just executing an algorithm, you know, rule set, you'd still be able to recognize that it wasn't playing like a real human being. You could sort of see the shortcomings in the algorithm.
Well, one of the things that I think is interesting about their definitions of strategic games too have to do with the idea that the people know all the players know all the consequences of what they're doing, which I think we all know in practice is not true. People make mistakes too that they should have anticipated, and they do dumb things all the time. But I think that's one of the things that AIs will often end up with is there's usually some gaps where they do something that's just patently wrong. Just because in a sufficiently complex game, I think if you see that more than a couple times, you start realizing what you're saying, that it's, yeah, this is clearly on rails and it's doing something wrong.
Right.
Okay, so then the thing I wanted to talk about, though, is that this whole book is about analyzing and trying to come up with better forms of play, or at least coming to solutions on games and the problems thereof. If you had an AI program that essentially uses the knowledge of this book as part of its algorithm, I mean, obviously this will be, we're talking that this is going to be a computer AI and not a flow chart or anything more limiting like that, then if it's using the stratagems that's presented here and using the probability calculations and so on and so forth, do you feel that that would get you closer to making it feel like you're playing against another human player, or at least another real player?
I definitely think so. I mean, I think that I'm only through the first three chapters of the book so far, but I definitely think that there's the way they're looking at the strategy and in games in this book, I think is a really interesting way to deconstruct what's going on behind the scenes. And so I think that's really important in trying to design around it. You talked about how the focus of the book is talking about finding those perfect play and mastering games. And it's funny because I almost look at this book as like, this is what people are trying to do to my games. And so it's like seeing the secret document that the other side has. And I'm like, oh, that's what you're doing. Okay. So this is how we now need to counteract that. I thought a good example of that was from the next chapter in the book where they were talking about doing flowchart trees of decision-making within the game. And they were talking about a situation that somebody has to do something about player X. And the turns are in order. And one person like, well, I don't want to do it. And I don't have to yet because there's two people who move after me.
Right.
You know? And we've all played games like that. Mm-hmm. And there's some great games that sometimes have that issue. And we've all played games like that. And to be honest, it sucks. Yeah. As a player, you're like, you hate that feeling of either having to be a bad table player, and I'm not going to solve the puzzle because there's no self-interest for me to solve that puzzle. I'm going to push it off and make you solve the puzzle. And then that person just gets pissed at you. And you just don't feel good about it, too. You feel like the game kind of let you down in some way. So it's interesting because, you know, at one hand, I think the book would say, okay, we've solved this puzzle. You know, they did that example of who's going to pay to make the garden pretty and presented it kind of like, well, this is perfect. It's the perfect way to solve the puzzle. And I keep thinking that the person at the beginning of the tree whose right decision is to never pay for the garden is an idiot. Right. And so then... As game designers, I think we start thinking then about what do I do to the game to make it so that is never the solution.
You remind me, in Seven Wonders, I remember in this at a tournament, I was faced with a situation, a player two spots away from me was building the science strategy, right? The more green cards they get, the more points they get. And I got passed a hand with one green card in it. And I immediately went through the game theory and I realized I could burn the green card now, or I could pass it to my opponent between me and the science player. He's absolutely got to burn that green card if I pass it to him. So that's good. I get the best of both worlds. I'll play a blue card, whatever I need, and I'll pass the green card, and he'll have to burn the green card unless he's dumb. And he was dumb, and he passed him the green card. Whereas if I get a hand with two green cards, now I know I've got to burn one, and he's got to burn the other one. But yes, exactly. You're sort of, it's that the whole garden problem where... if I can put another opponent in a situation where he's got to do what I needed to get done anyway, that's so much the better.
But Paul, was he dumb or was he anticipating playing a game with you in the future? So you burned.
That's true. The tournament format didn't necessarily, in fact, that tournament format, he was guaranteed not to play against me again later because only one person from that table would advance.
So he has every incentive to do as well as possible, irregardless.
Right. He was signaling for future rounds in the same game. He's like, don't pass me green cards. I'm just going to give them to him. You're going to have to burn them because I'm not going to burn them.
That's right. I think that these components that the book is talking about and delving into, and the more that you can try and incorporate those things into AIs, whether it's real or as approximated and faked as possible, I think the more interesting you can make those AIs and the more interesting you can make the games that use them, rely on them. So I think the whole book is going to be... and. Like I said, I can't wait to get into more of them, but the chapters, but I think it'll really help.
And the more, I'll say realistic for lack of a better word, but the better the AI in terms of how it makes decisions, so to speak, or how it emulates decision making, the more I think the game theory applies, where you kind of have to map out what are the possible things the AI is going to do and what is in the AI's interest to do, and therefore how do I anticipate that and make my decision in such a way that I get my maximum payoff, assuming that he's going to make a decision anticipating my good decision. And it's well-constructed, and that would pass the Turing test, in a manner of speaking.
I actually will counter that. I'm going to say that the game theory is important no matter what, because you're going to need the game theory to recognize when the AI is making a bad decision. Just as much as you need the game theory to recognize when the AI is making a good decision. And it will always be a test of you to use the game theory correctly. You're just trying to figure out, are you facing a rational or an irrational AI?
Just like you always have to decide if you're facing irrational or irrational people, human players as well.
And what's funny about that is that I think the book is very clear on this, is that even if you think you might be playing against an irrational player, you still have to treat them as if they are a rational player. You can't take a different move because, you know, oh, they might just pick the wrong thing and then give me 50 million points. No, you still have to play as if the other player is rational.
There was a counterexample to that in, I think, chapter 5, which Doug will get to, where I seem to remember player B had two choices that were very small differences. Like one of them, he would get 99 points, and the other one, he would get 100 points, regardless of what player A did. So clearly, I think player B's choices were left and right. Left would give him 99 points, right would give him 100 points. Player A, whose choices were up or down, if player B went left as he should, player A would get the most points. But if player B...
would also get 100 points. Yeah.
You're right. But if player B went right and sacrificed a point, player A would lose like 10,000 points or something crazy like that. So player A, especially among human beings, player A would tend to go conservative, choose the option that gave him a little bit less of a payoff in case player B was irrational and went the wrong way and ended up costing him 1,000 points.
And I think that clarifies, it's not that the book says you play the same if the player's irrational. The book does say if you think you're facing an irrational player, you do change your strategy. And the whole idea of credible commitments is trying to convince someone that you're already a rational player so that they do change their strategy so you get the payout you want.
That's a good segue into another discussion on signaling and screening, because this is another thing that, Doug, you brought up in your blog post, and I think you still got it a little wrong. That's there too. Now, Aaron, please correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I think the trickiest part about signaling and screening is that these are elements that happen before players take their move. Before they play the game, they're doing these other things outside the game, trying to signal their intent or try to screen out what they think the other player is going to do.
So signaling and screening can take place in moves before a particular move. You know, games are multiple moves in many times, not just a single move game. So you can have signaling and screening within a game.
Right. It isn't necessarily a communication outside the mechanics of the game itself. You can be signaling by making a move.
Okay.
By implementing a decision.
Okay. Yeah. That's interesting.
Example, I'm vindicated.
About how moving your military pieces in this attack a castle game, where once you've made the move, a credible signal, they're going to go that direction.
And Doug, you were talking about Scotland Yard and how, in my mind, when you were saying that, oh, Mr. X moves onto the metro line and puts down a metro token, that's a signal that he's on the metro line. But in my mind, I'm thinking, well, wait, he's already just gone onto the metro line. You know, how is that a signal to an action if it's an action that they've already done?
I don't know.
But I think that you were more accurate in your counterexample that then the detectives start to move towards the metro stations just to see what Mr. X is going to do. And that is a proper use of screening, because then you're like, oh, well, if you think you're going that way, well, let's find out if that's really what your intent is and start to close in.
Yeah. The whole idea of if you're doing the right thing as the detectives, then you're theoretically applying pressure to Mr. X and Mr. X will react accordingly. I mean, I played a lot of Scotland Yard in the day, and I feel like when you played Scotland Yard, you always wanted to do little moves. The taxis were great because every space pretty much is a taxi. So it narrowed nothing down for the detectives. And then if you're really panicky, you're using things like black tickets, you know, your very limited supply of black tickets or double move tickets. You're spending those, you know, one or two bullets you've got to really try and get yourself out of trouble. And the idea of, you know, moving to try to elicit responses from Mr. X is where I was trying to go with that. But you're right, it was a mechanic that did a thing. But one of the things I was thinking about is that outside of hidden move games, I was having a lot of trouble thinking of games where there's screening within the mechanics of the game. There's a lot of games where you can have banter and discuss moves and discuss what someone should or shouldn't do before the game and add some screening layers to that. But as an actual mechanic of the game, I couldn't come up with a lot that weren't hidden movement games.
The person who taught me how to play Resistance, one of the things he does is he will nominate, you know, a committee or a squad or a mission team, I guess. Mm-hmm. And then he will vote against the one that he nominated. And the whole purpose of that exercise is to see how everybody reacts to his nomination. So he's really screening to see where people are going to vote when he throws out a candidate mission team.
I somehow forgot about the whole genre of hidden role moves.
Okay. Yeah, that's true. It's not, but again, you're right, hidden information kind of thing.
I guess that's the rub, right? Is how many games involve truly hidden information? I mean, especially with the Euro games, usually the vast majority of your information is public. Mm-hmm. There's usually some hidden information, like maybe you have a card or two, or maybe a secret agenda.
Right. You know, and that's a good point. Like, I think of Agricola, for example. You've got a hand of cards that you don't share, but it's not like you're bluffing with them or anything. You know, people aren't saying, well, gee, I wonder if he's got, you know, a certain occupation or a certain minor improvement. No, you don't really think that way, really, when you're playing Agricola. You really just sort of play your own game and you think, well, it looks like he's going to need wood for fences, so I'm going to take the wood. That's about the most interaction you'll see. So yeah, you're right. In the case of Eurogames in particular, you're right. There's not a whole lot of hidden information that you have to try to elicit from your opponents.
Well, the hidden information you're trying to elicit is what of their strategy you do not know. They have the stuff in their head of what they're trying to achieve, and you may make them really committed to that strategy, or if you can push them in their direction. I believe you made a reference, Paul, a long time ago about a game where, I think it might have been Agricola, where you were in a similar situation. You needed to build your walls to have all the sheep. So once you made that, well, that's more of a credible commitment than a screen. You suspect that Paul was banking on the sheep.
You then take the sheep. Somebody else takes the sheep first.
I wonder if one of the rubs with this is that you have to be willing to burn a move or an action in order to do the screen. And so there's certain games like Agricola where do I want to burn one of my people just to see if you're trying to collect sheep, just to take sheep in and see if you're really upset about it or not. If you really want to design a game that has screening as an element, you may have to think about a whole class of moves or actions that you can take that are basically just screens or give people the leeway within the actions that they can take so that is a valid, useful action. I almost feel like you almost have to maybe build the game around that idea.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Can you think of an example of a game that has as a fundamental action narrowing down information from an opponent?
Clue.
Sleuth.
That's true. Well,
I mean, those are deduction games by
by
trade, by their very nature.
Well, that's true. Clue is a simple one, right? In Clue, I ask if you've got a knife. I'll say the knife Mrs. White in the kitchen to find out whether my opponents have any of those cards.
But I think that's another good example where you can do some other really interesting things in Clue too, where you guess things that you have. As a way of bluffing, and it goes around the table and no one's got it. And everyone's like writing that down. And you're like, So Clue is a really interesting example. There's probably a lot more you can do with Clue than I would have thought on that.
Yeah. My son actually once asked for three things that he already had and threw everybody else off for the whole game.
Yeah.
You develop a new appreciation for Clue.
It's next level Clue.
It's the next level.
Right.
Now, I'm still going to push us back to this, though. I mean, we're starting to talk about the challenges of putting in screens in the board game in general. How do you do that for an AI? Is this even possible for an AI? I mean, this seems like the ultimate design challenge there. There we go. Our challenge after this discussion, we want someone to make a solo game where if an AI who can screen and react to the information.
Wow.
That the player is putting out. So you design the board game to be to screen and to bluff and to react to what you're doing.
I'll be so the giant. Player,
the game require elicits information from the player and then reacts to the information that the player chooses to reveal. Wow.
It's actually probably easier than we think.
It might be.
But
we just haven't.
The thing is that if it's a pre-programmed strategy every time and how they react, then the AI is too predictable, and you can purposely the screening action to get the reaction that you want to manipulate the AI.
So it sounds like what you really want is you want the AI to have a randomized set of goals or strategies that it's trying to achieve, and then the action that the player takes somehow reveals some piece of that to try and give them some clue. I assume you wouldn't want it to be perfect, right? You'd want there to be some Venn diagrammy overlap on the information you're going to get as to whether or not it points to this direction or that direction, maybe.
And then it kind of goes both ways, because it sounds like the information you choose to reveal, you're using to elicit information about the AI strategy.
So the screening goes both ways. So the game is trying to screen you, and you're also trying to screen the game.
Yeah, let me see what happens if I show the game this. Yeah.
Oh, it's an AI, so you can't get away from being a puzzle.
Yeah.
Well,
see, and ultimately, I think that's where this topic lands. I mean, an AI is necessarily an algorithm and necessarily a solvable problem, at least theoretically. The problem we get into, though, is, and we had this with chess. I mean, theoretically, chess is a solvable game, except for the fact that we don't have the computational power to solve it, so we have to treat it differently. And I think that's probably true for a lot of AIs as well. Theoretically, it's a solvable puzzle, But if the AI is sufficiently advanced, you kind of have to treat it as a decision-making player and act accordingly.
But if it's significantly advanced, is it practical to implement it in a board game?
In a board game, that's hard, right?
In a live board game, it's difficult. But if you're playing against a created program that's digital, then it can play against you. And my counterexample to it being a puzzle is that I think looking at Google's DeepMind technology. Google's DeepMind technology is the technology that was used to create AlphaGo, which is a computer program that has bested some of the best Go players in the world to play the game of Go. And Go is an even more complex game than chess ever is. In the book that we read, they give the example that you could solve chess, but it would take about the length of time of the sun in order to solve it in its game tree. Meanwhile, Go players would say, yes, but if you were to try to game tree out a game of Go, once you get to the 32nd move in the game, of which there are hundreds of moves, once you get to the 32nd move, there are more options than there are atoms in the observable universe. So go figure that one out. And it took a team of like 12, 15 people, 2 years to create a software program that was using the technology called DeepMind, where it's effectively a computer program that's able to play against itself and learn from itself how to better play the game and beat the best human players in the world in the game of Go. So I take that example and I think, you know, I bet that if we could get a team of 6 people using that technology and applying that to, say, like Twilight Struggle, you could create the best Twilight Struggle computer player ever that would nearly be unbeatable by a human player. The only thing is that no game company would have the people or resources in order to actually carry out that program. Like there's not enough money to invest into it.
Right.
But to make that happen.
But okay, but Go is a game which has a couple things going for it that make it much, much easier. But wait, first of all, the thing about this Google thing is it's not doing like a formal game theory of everything. It's collecting information on strategies. It's one of our solutions to complex games that's brought up in earlier chapters, which is you find these localized strategies. Twilight Struggle. I haven't played it before, but I have the impression it's a lot like diplomacy. Am I correct in my assumption about that?
That is not correct.
All right.
It's a card-driven area control game between strictly 2 players.
Aaron, I think you were thinking of, the huge space opera game that's called Twilight
Imperium 3.
Imperium. Which is a bit more diplomacy. And I get those confused all the time, actually, too.
I just hope we're not getting too egotistical here to say that Twilight Imperium 3 is, on balance, oodles more complex than the board game Go.
Well, I think one of the things that makes it complex is that there's a lot of person-to-person interaction and the diplomacy element of negotiating. And that I think that stuff is harder sometimes to solve, air quotes. Mm-hmm. And actually, one of the things I think is interesting as we talk about these AIs and how they work, I get the sense that the authors of the book kind of foresee that all games are solvable. You know, we've talked about how we don't have the computational power to pull it off, but from a hypothetical, theoretical standpoint, they're all solvable. And beyond the fact that as a game designer, that bothers me because you never want to make a solvable game, right? I mean, if the game's solvable, you failed, it's a bad game. So I don't know if I have a cognizant point to this other than I'm bothered by it, but it's something that I think is interesting. I mean, it maybe brings me back to the idea of, sure, all the games are solvable, but are they solvable by the players as they sit down to play it? You know, which is kind of a little bit like the Turing test for the AI. Yeah, the AI is not perfect. The AI is not screening. It's not a person, no matter how much computational power we put behind it. But if it's good enough, is that okay? And it may not be okay for the authors of the book. They're academics. This is very important to them. But as game designers, it might be.
Which I think is actually a great place to do this conversation because it comes to the big concern about AI. And it tells us that Doug here is ready to listen to the next episode.
I am. And I've been dying to, and I need to do it. I'll let you know when I do.
And I completely agree that with Doug's point that as you continue to go through this book, the whole idea is that there are these games, and while there may not be perfect solutions, if you can put a game on paper, there should be conceptually, mathematically, a way to come up with at least probabilities for your best solutions of actually coming through and solving said game. Even if the solving the game is like, well, 80% of the time I'm going to do this and 20% of the time I'm going to do that, that's still in their minds considered to be solved because you've at least figured out what your probabilities are of doing one thing over another.
And doing anything different from that strategy reduces your likely payoff. Right. But I think all of the game theory we've seen so far presupposes rational decision makers and good knowledge of what the ultimate payoffs are as a consequence of their decisions. You know, if I do this and he does that, then I'm going to get this. And that we have correctly characterized what their perception of their rewards is. Assuming those two things, correctly characterizing payoffs and rational players, I think the game theory holds up really well. As game designers, the extent to which I think we manipulate those things, either we can render payoffs ambiguous, we can reward irrational play. or give players the opportunity to signal intent for irrational play that might cause other players to second guess what would normally be the correct rational strategy. And I think that's what makes games interesting.
As we get close to wrapping up here, I actually wanted to ask Paul a question. Paul, I believe in the last episode, you had said that one of the reasons you got into reading this book in the first place was because you wanted to try to find a better way of dealing with this issue of AI in games. And I have to ask, has this helped you solve any of your questions so far?
Yes and no. So it does kind of give me a good perspective on what that would entail, but it also tells me that it's a more difficult problem than I imagined because of how well you have to characterize the game and the extent to which you have to be able to contain the game in terms of your computational ability, or like we were talking about before in the case of a physical board game, you know, the algorithm really boils down to, I've gained a greater appreciation for how difficult it is to construct the game in a way that's sufficiently challenging from a decision-making standpoint. So yeah, it's given me more insight. It hasn't made it easier to solve the problem.
Okay.
Thank you, Douglas, for coming on and being our guest.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Yes, it's been great having you.
You can read more about Douglas's projects and his work on his blog at lucidphonix.blogspot.com, or you can follow him on Twitter at Douglas Twitt himself.
I'm never on Twitter. Except for when you tweet me.
So everybody tweet at him all the time.
Yes. At Lucid Phoenix is my Twitter handle.
Where does that name come from? Any place in particular, or does it just, it's just a cool thing?
It comes from my old role-playing days, actually. I was a big role player back in the day, and I think I had a character in Shadowrun called Lucid Phoenix, and I thought that was cool. So next thing you know,
that's cool.
My handle.
I think that's where Scott Alms came up with the name for Gamelin Games. He had a character in a role-playing game called Gamelin or something like that.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it kind of sounds like it, doesn't it?
Yeah. So the best way to reach me probably is on Twitter at Paulo and Games. I can be contacted on Board Game Geek. I'm PDO3. If you want to just hear my voice, I'm on Dice Tower News. DiceTowerNews.com/podcast. Oh, and then, of course, my blog is paulowandgames.blogspot.com.
This is Dr. Witz, at Dr. Witz. And you can learn more about us at dr.witz.com.
Okay, so that's going to bring us to another end of Paul Owen and Dr. Witz Colloquium on Games of Strategy by Dixit, Skeeth, and Riley. We want to thank again our special guest today, Doug Schultz. And before we wrap up, I just want to point out that Watson was able to beat a bunch of poker players in poker. So, you know, bluffing, intuition, yeah, maybe. I hope we've left you with some good design challenges for all you designers out there. Have a good night.
Thank you.